Okay, great. Thanks to Luca and Celine for putting down this meeting, and PI for the great hospitality. So, okay, I stay in the Carol theme, just like the previous talks, in fact, with a slightly different focus. So I'm going to talk about Carol symmetry in gravity and string theory. And the work I'm going to be talking about sort of on the gravity side is contained in these papers, and on the string theory side in these papers and earlier works. And I also want to advertise my colleague Gerben Oling, who is here, who will actually give a very interesting, closely related talk Thursday on conformal Carol scalars. And some of what I'm going to be talking about is background for his talk. To lift the overall motivation, and in particular my motivation, is I like to start by showing this cube of physical theories, because the work I'm going to be talking about was in part motivated by examining rather an opposite limit than the Carol limit, namely the sort of Galilean limit, or non-relativistic, so the large speed of light limit of various frameworks in physics. So to sort of put that in perspective, this cube of physical theories, where you depict along the axis the three constants of nature, h bar, g newton, and 1 over the speed of light, sort of instructive. I don't want to talk through all the corners, but what sort of brings us together here, and actually many of our colleagues have common goal, is to understand quantum gravity better. For some people, that string theory doesn't necessarily have to be, but that's sort of the framework where I come from. But within this cube, actually the most traveled route to approach quantum gravity is coming from either the quantum field theory side and saying, hey, let's turn on gravity, or from the GR side, say, let's turn on quantum effects. But a less often traveled path is to come from this side, the so-called non-relativistic quantum gravity corner. Okay, so examining this cube, I've been doing with my collaborators for the last many years, showed various novelties already at the classical level of understanding better the non-relativistic limit of classical GR, and devising some string theories that are candidates for non-relativistic quantum gravity. But then, so obviously when you look, or maybe not obviously, but when you look at this cube, so this is the c going, the speed of light to infinity limit, you can also wonder what happens sort of at the other extreme of this cube when you send certain constants to zero, like, or well, to infinity, h bar or g newton. I in particular want to send 1 over c to infinity, i.e. The speed of light to zero. So that's what this talk is mostly about. And as we also heard in other talks, so if you send the speed of light to zero, and one of the first persons to look at that was Lévy-Leblanc, then actually the Poincaré symmetry group contracts, becomes a certain non-trivial contraction of it. And he called this the Carol algebra, or the Carol symmetry group. And it has various peculiar features, like, well, the name originates from the fact that in such a theory, you run, but you actually don't move. The physics becomes, at least for standard particles, ultra-local. Objects only move in time and not in space anymore. That by itself sounds quite singular, but just like in the non-relativistic case, a lot of progress can be made by sort of starting in the non-relativistic realm and turning on relativistic corrections. The idea is that maybe you can do the same and learn more about gravity or string theory or field theory in general, and expand relativistic theories around C equals zero. And the hope would be that the Carol symmetry of the limiting point, C equals zero, would give some organizing principle for a perturbative expansion around it. Just a word on terminology. I will use sometimes the word Carolian, sometimes C to zero, where C is the speed of light, and sometimes ultra-local. Sometimes you also see the terminology ultra-relativistic. I rather use ultra-local, because ultra-relativistic Well, the terminology ultra-relativistic is more like speeds going very close to the speed of light, so v over c going to 1. This is rather c going to 0, or in particular, because c is dimension full, some dimensionless ratio, c over a characteristic velocity in the system going to 0. And that's different from this. Okay, this is kind of elementary, so I will not spend too much time, but just to show where we're coming from. So here are the Boost symmetries for Lorentz. People are very familiar with the Galilean Boost, which is the C to infinity limit of Lorentz Boost. In the Carroll limit, you do the opposite, and C goes to 0, and you see sort of the duality between it, whereas time is absolute here. Here, space is absolute, and here, space is sort of relative in a Galilean sense, and here, time is relative in a Carolian sense. And when I talk about geometry, when I talk about, say, Carroll geometry, and likewise, but that's not what this talk about, is Newton-Cartan geometry, I mean the geometries that make these Boost symmetries local, in the same sense that Riemannian geometry makes Lorentz symmetry local, i.e. incorporates Einstein's equivalence principle that freely falling observers see the laws of special relativity. So just one more sort of trivial slide, but to show you what's happening. So in Lorentz symmetry, we have, of course, light cones at 45-degree angles. Sending the speed of light to zero, to infinity, opens up the light cone, gives a Galilean structure, and the corresponding geometry that makes this symmetry local is known as torsional Newton-Cartan geometry. It's not the subject of this talk so much. I'll review briefly some developments. But then in Carroll geometry, the opposite happens. Light cones close up, and the corresponding geometry that makes that Carroll symmetry local, I will call Carroll geometry. So you can see I'm talking a lot about geometry here, and in fact, much of this recent progress in understanding this cube and this non-relativistic corner of the cube of physical theories, but also both in the context of the large and small speed of light limit, and using that to study corners of gravity, quantum field theory, string theory, all that has sort of a common denominator, namely it builds on improved understanding of something that you can lump together under the name non-Lorentzian geometries. So it's a kind of a bucket name for everything that's not Lorentzian and that you can learn in GR books. So space-times with local symmetries other than Lorentz. And actually, there's quite a list of fascinating problems and settings in modern physics where non-Lorentzian geometries have found a role. They appear in boundary geometries in non-ADS holography, covariant formulations of post-Newtonian approximations, covariant formulations of non-Lorentzian fluids, Horowitz-Lipschitz gravity, double field theory. And that's the focus of my talk here in the bold face, also in the ultra-local corner of GR. And maybe, so it's maybe not so clear, but hopefully at the end of the talk this is clear, it actually also appears in certain corners of non-relativistic string theory. And before going to the outline and the meat of the talk, as we have also heard in this interesting workshop, there are quite some occurrences of Carroll symmetries, Carroll structures, Carroll fluids, Carroll field theories appearing in recent years. And we have heard and will hear more about this in these readings, but so they play a role in Carroll, in null hypersurfaces in Lorentzian geometries because they exhibit Carolian symmetries. The fact that the BMS group is isomorphic to the conformal Carroll group is playing a big role. We also saw it in the last talk in understanding flat space holography and understanding celestial holography. Chiral symmetries have appeared in tensionless limits of strings. And at the very end, I'll comment a little bit on that. And as I say, and that's sort of the main part of this talk, they appear in limits and expansions of general relativity as we know it. And it seems to lead to solvable corners, like more easy to treat corners of GR that can maybe be a crutch to understand in a perturbative way, more complicated. And that's also any questions? Okay. So the plan is sort of it's two parts. They are related in the sense that they have chiral in common. I mean, the emphasis will be the first part, chiral symmetry and gravity. I will start by giving a perspective on chiral geometry. I think it's important to say that we see this also in this talk, that there are slightly different perspectives coming. And where these differences come from. But I'll start by that and then go to the main part of the small speed of light expansion of GR. Turns out that to do that, it's rather useful to first rewrite GR, a sort of pre-ultra local parameterization. Then I will discuss the actions and the equations of motions and classes of solutions that you get from that at leading order and next to leading order. And then the second part, show you the appearance of chiral symmetry in string theory. Just in a nutshell, how it appears. There's a certain, to start with, null relativistic string theory. And if you don't know what that is, I will try to summarize it in two transparencies. If you start with null relativistic string theory, you can take further limits on the world sheet. And one of those leads to a world sheet theory. So there are apparently novel two-dimensional world sheet theories coming out of well-defined limits of string theory that have whose Polyakov form of the axiom shows two-dimensional Carolian world sheet structures, and there's also some emerging BMS group there as a residual symmetry group. Probably that will be rather short. Okay, let's get some equations then. So my starting point for chiral geometry is the structures that we have seen before. You have a time-like vector field, I call it V mu, and a spatial metric, H mu down, and in some settings it's nice to think of that as being composed out of spatial field binds. So A here would be tangent space, spatial indices. So one way you can get this geometry from a more algebraic or gauging point of view is to take the chiral algebra, so the particular contraction of the Lorentz, of the Poincaré algebra for C to zero, and you make that local, and you turn translations into diffeomorphisms, and then you still have some non-trivial local tangent space transformations, Carolian boosts, and local rotations. And then you'll find in particular that these geometrical objects transform in a certain way on a Carolian boost. This would be invariant, and H mu nu would also be invariant, but you can invert these field binds and construct an inverse spatial matrix, and it would be transforming on a certain way under spatial Galilean boost, Carolian boost. These that you can also define in various, you know, besides time-like vector field, you can define its inverse here, connected to the Erismann connection, tau mu, a one form, and they satisfy the following orthogonality relations. When you want to do geometry and dynamical geometry, you of course like to introduce a connection. So We're all familiar, of course, in Riemannian geometry with the Christoffel connection. Here, it's useful, and we can make a longer story, but I'll just tell you a very nice connection that also appears naturally when from GR. It's the following Carroll compatible connections. You see, it's a connection made out of the various geometric fields, T and V and Lie derivatives, and it involves in particular the extrinsic curvature, K, which is the Lie derivative along the time-like direction of the spatial metric. And this has a nice property that it sort of satisfies the analog of metric, of what we know as metric compatibility in GR. Namely, the invariant tensors here are left invariant under this connection. So the covariant derivative of respect to this connection on V and H vanishes.
Niels, there is a question.
But it isn't unique, no, the connection that this guy...
It's not unique. It's not unique. But this is a sort of a connection that has minimal, in a well-defined sense, minimal torsion, in the sense that you can see there is some torsion here, and it will be proportional to the extrinsic curvature. But it's not unique. But that's true.
But so how do you select it? Because it's the one that come out of some...
I select it because it sort of rolls out in a natural way out of GR. Now that you out of our limit of GR. But let's say, the non-uniqueness part would be some adding some extra tensors to it. What's crucial is, of course, that whatever you... this here transforms like a connection. Then the arbitrariness is always adding some other tensors to it. So in a sense, I don't think it makes a big difference for, let's say, the equations of motions of the theory. Yes. But good point. It's not unique.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, I have a naive question. Where is lambda? You say it's a boost, but where does it act?
Lambda, so there are two types of internal transformations, Carolian boosts and spatial rotations. Spatial rotations, let's forget about it because things are everything is invariant under spatial rotations. For example, here you can see, these would transform under spatial rotations, but H would be invariant. So lambda is the parameter associated to Carolian boost.
Okay.
Just a group theory parameter.
Normally
that lives in the tension space. So it would have an index A. But I've pushed it forward to the space-time just by contracting it with the field bind. That's really what lambda mu is.
So lambda is a boost contracted with the field bind.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are different ways of writing it. Maybe this one was, I thought it was simpler, but it's simpler because you don't need other indices, but it's more confusing because it's actually through the boost parameter, lives in tangent space.
Why you got confused. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the question. So what we'll soon see is that, this structure, this way of looking at Carolian geometry follows bottom up from gauging the Carroll algebra, from making it local. As we'll soon see, this also follows just from the small C limit in general relativity, to which I will come now. To start attacking the small, or for that matter also the large speed of light expansion of GR, you have to sort of start somewhere. So what do? You write the metric in a way that resembles the so-called 3+1 formulation of GR. So it's still covariant, but we sort of single out the time-like field bind and separate out the transverse spatial metric. It's still fully covariant tensors. So these things transform, as you would think, under diffeomorphisms and under local Lorentz. But we put a C squared here, that's sort of physical input, that the zero-zero component of the metric. We also know this from the connection to Newtonian gravity. That's where the speed of light sits. So also in the non-relativistic limit, c going to infinity, this is the dominating part. The assumption is then that when we want to start plugging this in to Einstein-Hilbert, that the remaining tensors, so here, for example, t and pi, are Taylor series in the thing you want to expand in. And so Taylor series in c squared, when we want to do the small speed of light expansion, or 1 over c squared, which I will not do in this talk, when you will do the large speed of light expansion. So that's our starting point. It's written down here again. There's an analogous form for the inverse metric. Now, well, it turns out to be very useful to first undo the beauty of GR, you could say, to get ready to do an expansion. We have learned this also from non-relativistic expansions. If you want to do the Carolean expansion, there's slightly more convenient parameterization to do this, but it's very analogous. That has a name. We call it the pull connection, the pre-ultra local expansion, parameterization. And essentially what it also boils down to is taking a nice connection, which makes the Einstein-Hilbert action look nice in terms of these new variables where time and space are sort of split off, but still obeying local Lorentz. So here's sort of the avatar of this, but you could say the relativistic, the Lorentzian avatar of this connection that you just also asked about, but now in a fully relativistic setting, defined in terms of all these tensors here, V, T, and pi. As you can maybe already guess, and that's going to be the next point, now if you're going to now expand, the leading order part of this connection will precisely be the Carroll compatible connection that I introduced before. But long story short, just use this nice connection, do a lot of algebra, then the Einstein-Hilbert action, and again, I emphasize fully relativistic, takes a nice form, where now there are certain parts that have explicit dependence on C, because we made it explicit. There's a leading order term here, C to the zero term here, and sorry for the typo, this is C squared. You can see here sort of the kinetic term here. So this is the spatial prediction of the curvature, so it's like the spatial curvature. And here is a term that is essentially the torsion of this time-like one form squared.
Nils, a question.
Yes, sorry.
I just have a technical question, because you have a singularity on the inverse of G when C goes to zero. The connection seems to have no singularity. Or is it hidden? There must be someone over C.
No, okay. Yeah, no. Good. Thanks for asking. This I can just define like this. When I start expanding all the tensors here, T and V, you will actually see that C tilde starts at order 1 over C. There's a 1 over C squared piece, okay. C to the 0, C squared piece. You just plug it all in, and you get something. But just to say, the 1 over C squared term, you can actually show, is purely tensorial. The part that transforms like a connection sits precisely in the C to the 0 part.
What you call C tilde is the C to the 0 part. Like you have extracted,
exactly.
You have subtracted.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. It's here. So the Carolean connection is C tilde evaluated for C equals 0, where you have subtracted out the divergent part.
I haven't understood, but from where is coming from this pre-ultra local connection? So what the property that it gives you a nice action at the end,
yeah.
But
yeah,
I mean,
okay.
How did you manage to think about it? No, suppose.
Okay, maybe I should go back. Yeah, they're different. So we first found a similar connection actually in our earlier work during the non-relativistic expansion. How do we find it? You can find it sort of by brute force, by forcing a nice form. In the end, what we did, you can also understand this slightly more general by looking at the Pallottini action and thinking of connections as being a priori GLDR valued. Now, what you normally do is, you normally in GR adapt them to some kind of, to a Lorentzian invariant tensor. But you could also embed in GLDR a Galilean invariant tensor. And so so in that way, you can even in a GR sense say, it's from a GR point of view, it's unnatural to look at the embedding of the Galilean group in GLDR. So you wouldn't do it, but you can do it. And if you would do it, you would get another connection and it would have torsion already in GR. It's not the most efficient way of doing GR. It turns out that if you want, I want to start expanding, it is an efficient way. So in that sense, there is sort of a more mathematical way to arrive at it. So, I mean, that also answers the question. We got many questions always like, how can you get in torsion from a theory without torsion? Because we take GR and doesn't have torsion, and you start to do limits, and suddenly it has torsions. But that's just because you want to, there's a freedom of choice in connections, and to start to do expansions, you just use that freedom to your advantage.
Sorry to continue the interruptions, but one more question, just about the general logic. You said you're taking the C going to zero limit of GR, but actually, not of just GR, but GR with a chosen foliation, right? Because this is going to give you the time-like vector that you have in your Carolian geometry. GR does not come with a time-like
vector. Yeah, no, okay. It assumes. Yeah, no, okay, that's true. It assumes we have metrics that are writable in such a way, right?
Yeah, but then you pick one. The time-like vector that you have in the Carolian geometry, it corresponds to this T here, right? Or not?
That's right, because maybe it's good to show this transparency now. So now when we're going to expand, so these are the unexpanded things, and we're going to now assume we can expand them in Taylor series. We're going to have leading order fields and next to leading order fields, et cetera, et cetera. Indeed, so the leading order fields here and their inverses here, that's going to, That's going to map onto the Carolian geometry that I introduced before, sort of ab initio.
Okay, but before you do this expansion, then the theory is equivalent to GR before you do the expansion, right? You just pick a foliation. And are you going to fix the shift vector equal zero in this foliation, or you allow it? Arbitrary shift vectors.
I'm not going. I'm allowing it. It's fully general.
Okay.
So okay, that's good. That brings us to this transparency. So now we're just gonna expand, and of course, I also took the same notation. You see that the leading order fields here, and again, these are the inverse, will define for you Carolian geometry. These transformation properties that I showed you before with the ab initio, you can just derive because you know how these transform under local Lorentz. There's a speed of light dependence. You just take C to zero, and you find the Carolian transformations. It's not rocket science, it's what you expect, but it's nice to see. So the small C expansion gives Carol Boost transformations. And then, okay, this is sort of set up like that. The expansion of the connection gives you the Carol compatible connection. And like I said, similar things were done before. Okay, now we're just...
Yes, just a little comment. You may also have considered 1 over C square terms, right?
Sort of super leading terms in here.
Yeah, probably. The way that you have written there is completely free. You have T and pi.
Okay, no, but that's not, I could have. I think we don't, we don't do it because, there is a choice. But we made a choice to say, and we did the same in the non-relativistic, that's a physics-inspired choice to say the explicit C dependence in a metric or the inverse metric is like so, and these things start at order one. That's a choice. But you know, that doesn't mean that if you enlarge your framework, you couldn't find uninteresting things.
Well, I'm quoting that because I have a specific example in mind. This is the reason why But this choice that you made is perfectly fine. Yeah. You made this choice and you go through, and whatever you find is okay with Carol.
But it's not a God-given choice. Yeah, yeah. For sure. No. Okay. So now we're gonna expand Einstein Hilbert, and I'm gonna show you for you what the leading order action looks like, discuss its equations of motion and some solutions, and show that something has been simplifying. And of course, and I'm going to connect to results in the literature, also very old results. So the leading order action is maybe not surprising, right? So this is Einstein-Hilbert. I'm now going to plug in all the expansions. So curly K, which was still Lorentzian, becomes Carolian K. Let's put it like that. And that's all that survives here at leading order. So leading order, any child can do. Using this, but very brilliantly, I think, visionary. Mark Hanau wrote down this action in a very nice paper from way back called The Zero Signature Limit of GR. It's interesting how terminology has changed, right? He called it zero signature limit. I just had to think for a second, why did he call that? But, the signature involves C squared, right, in the timelike component. So if you send C to zero, it becomes like a zero signature. So this is sort of a purely kinetic, and that's also the hallmark, that's one way that Carolian field theories look like, purely sort of time derivatives, purely kinetic terms have Carolian boost symmetry. You can compute its equations of motions, we vary with respect to the Carolian fields, written down here, it's not so important, but pretty soon I'm going to show you that these split up in constraint equations and evolution equations, which are quite easy to solve. Before that, let me also say you can do the next to leading order action. You obviously get next to leading order this, but then evolved on the Carolian geometry, and then you have to expand this to next to leading order. It gives also some contribution. And it's essentially the spatial curvature plus some terms involving the higher order fields. Nice feature that's quite generic with these expansions or Lagrangian expansions in general is that you see that the equations of motion of the next two leading order fields, this M and phi, precisely implement the equations of motions of the that you got from the leading order fields, from the leading order action. That's a complicated way of saying that the equations of at any order in this expansion, all equations of motions of the lower orders are included at a given order. So it's consistent to truncate at a given order and then just focus on that Lagrangian. It includes all the dynamics from before.
In the variation of the leading order, I see that there's no boundary term. So the action work, Dirichlet conditions are good without boundary term.
We are sloppy here, or sloppy. I mean, thanks for the question. There is also a boundary term, in the upstairs theory. One should expand it, and not that it's not important. Using our way, it has not been done yet. But it would be nice to put the dots on the I. Thanks.
Thank you.
A good question. So that also says that I should also say this equality, even this thing here by itself, is up to boundary terms. So we know what they are, but it's just not totally written out. So there are boundary terms from the expansion and extra boundary terms from getting this nice form. And we should take them together. This action is closely related to another earlier obtained action by Eric Birkshoff, also some years ago. Okay, let's look at some features of the equations of motions. So the leading order theory, and Gerben has a nice way to put some extra information. Some people like to call this the electric theory, basically because it's dominated by time derivatives, and like in electromagnetism, electric fields are time derivatives. But the more generic name is the time-like theory. So these are sort of synonyms. We have equations of motions. Now you can contract them with various tensors. The bottom line is they take the form of some constraint equations on this extrinsic curvature and some evolution equations. And so once you have some initial data, this is actually quite easy equation. GR has simplified enormously because of this ultra-local feature. That's just at a given point evolution in time. So GR has reduced to ODEs. So given some initial data, which would be H0, so the metric on some spatial slice and the derivative of it, so the extrinsic curvature on some spatial slice, you can actually integrate these equations. So the bottom, the upshot is here, there's a much simpler evolution than in full GR. The question is this then also useful when you go to next order, for example, as a perturbative way? That could possibly be. We did a specific example of these initial data. There are so-called Bowen-York type solutions known in GR that represent black holes with some momentum and some angular momentum. You can construct the analog, the initial data of the analog of that, but now in this Carolian context of that, given here, and then you can solve for this psi and L bar parameters, and then you have the solution here in terms of H0 and K0. What's maybe interesting, and so you can compute physical boundary charges and indeed show that you can compute boundary charges corresponding to this momentum, linear momentum of the black hole and the angular momentum, but there's no mass charge at leading order. This was also observed in a paper around the same time by Perez. As we'll come to just in the next transparency, it appears that you need to go to next to leading order to see mass appearing as a charge. So that's what we will do now. Actually, I will not discuss the full NLO theory, but discuss a particular interesting truncation of it that's more easily manageable, even though I think it would still be very interesting, and we hope to examine the full NLO theory, because then it's a richer framework. But there is this consistent subsector of it that, again, has a sort of dual name. Some you can call it the magnetic theory, because it's actually dominated by gradients, but still has, in a kind of non-trivial way, Carolian Boost symmetry. But you can also call it the space-like theory, and Gerben will also comment on that.
So to make things clear in my mind, this is a separate theory, right? You have expanded in powers of C square, and each of the terms that you find starting from the original Einstein-Hilbert is on its own right a distinct theory, right? So the one that you showed previously was the electric. Well, this is the magnetic, and then maybe you have further.
That's a good question. Well, just pick. So if I would do full NLO, it includes LO because of the special nature of the equations of motion. So the full NLO has also the dynamics of LO because its equations of motions just rolls out, are implemented by the equations of motions of the extra fields you have done. From that perspective, it's not a separate theory. But indeed, now I'm focusing on a truncation of the NLO theory that's a separate theory. I don't agree. And interestingly enough, that the NLO theory it has a bigger symmetry than just Carroll. It is Carroll plus various symmetries that come from the next to leading order fields. The electric theory has pure Carroll symmetry, and precisely this truncation, the magnetic theory, also has pure Carroll theory. The truncation just makes sure. So there's actually two gravity theories that have just Carroll, electric and magnetic. So it's a separate theory, and that's why also it has separate types of solutions. Thanks for the question. So one way, so actually, so this theory was arrived at by Mark Hanau and Salgado Rebolodo using a Hamiltonian formalism. Here's a way to get it using a Lagrangian formalism, Lagrangian approach, which is not rocket science, but kind of cute, I think, and it's something that you can use sort of generically to get magnetic type theories for a scalar theory, limit, Carroll limit of scalar theory or electromagnetism. And the point is to sort of rewrite your original theory before the limit using a Lagrangian multiplier and then do the limit. So what am I doing here? And it's kind of cute because here also this pre-ultra local form of GR. I mean, I wouldn't know how to do this for the Einstein-Hilbert without knowing this pre-ultra local form. So you stare at this pre-ultra local form and you say, ah, there is another way I can write this quadratic term. Namely, I can introduce a Lagrangian multiplier chi, an appropriate metric that actually turns out to be the De Witt metric, such that when I integrate at chi, I reproduce the extrinsic curvature term squared. And in doing that, you have to keep track of factors of c, and there's a c squared here and no c here. And now you see you can do the c to zero limit of this action. So we're actually looking at the leading order action from this perspective. And all that survives is this, these two terms, which is, and this also makes it clear that it's a truncation of NLO. It's essentially the spatial curvature with a constraint that says that the extrinsic curvature should be zero. And that constraint is incorporated via Lagrangian multiplier. Again, you can look at the equations of motions. They separate again in constraint equations and evolution equations. And now, actually, contrary to the leading order theory, you can show that it has black hole-like solutions, and hence a mass charge appears. I just flash it here. I see I have only 10 minutes left, so I'll not speed up, that's bad style, but I still hope to say something about the string theory. So the last thing I want to mention here before mentioning in the last 10 minutes something about string theory is that, of course, natural to look at solutions with cosmological constant in this context. You have to decide, again, how you're going to expand the cosmological constant, whether it has a leading order piece, which in this setting would go like so, or an analog piece. Then the bottom line is a leading order cosmological constant can source De Sitter type solutions, and the analog constant can actually source both positive and negative lambda solutions. And you get, for example, some Carroll limit of De Sitter or anti-De Sitter in static coordinates.
We have a question on the chat.
Yes.
Yeah, there is a question in the chat. I have also a question, but let me start with the one in the chat. Sorry to interrupt.
It's been
a part a little bit before. There's Igor is asking, is it possible to build an isomorphism from the Clifold algebra with signature minus plus 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 and the Clifold algebra used in constructing spin bundles on null hypersurfaces?
I didn't get the first part. Is it possible to do what?
To build an isomorphism from the Clifford algebra with signature minus plus plus plus. You say, I believe this may be relevant to discuss Dirac matter fields.
I think, yeah, well, so if the question is more like how to add fermions to the story and do the Carroll limit of fermions?
I think it's related to that, yes.
So yes, and I think I have not looked at, you have maybe looked a little bit at it, Gerben, or not. But yeah. But it should be possible, just like in a non-relativistic case, and it would be important for, you know, various generalizations and adding, you know, fermionic matter to it, or doing super symmetric generalizations, which also various people always ask me.
All right, can I ask you my question, or you want at
no,
the
please.
End? Oh,
please.
Go ahead. Okay, I actually have the right slide. So you said there are like black hole solutions. I have some questions like, a black hole is a thermodynamical object, so it would be useful in my opinion, very interesting to study the properties of a black hole in a Carolian theory of gravity, for instance. What about Perros inequality, isoperimetric equations? Is the area of the black hole bound? That could be important to understand Carol itself, right?
Very much so. And yeah, of course, there have been interesting studies relating Carol to horizon properties from Laura and others. So such a study has not been done, but it would be for sure be interesting. Already just thinking, well, various people have done, you can sort of do it on the back of your envelope, but pretty soon you get a little confused. But, you know, studying the first law of, you know, reinstating factors of C in the first law of thermodynamics and studying C to zero. I got confused with a naive analysis, just to say, but maybe you have to do some double scaling limits. I mean, bottom line is, such questions are certainly interesting, and maybe having now sort of a framework to see these solutions to have black hole-like solutions. Okay, I call this a black hole because it's the Carolian limit of a Schwarzschild black hole in isotropic coordinates. That's why I call it a black hole, and it has a mass. But I'm actually, you know, I should be careful calling it a black hole because not really examine the horizon structure, and you have to sort of decide what is a horizon if you don't have a Lorentzian geometry anymore.
And can you know whether is there a singularity?
So the question is this here a singularity?
Like a true singularity, or there are some Carolian things you can do to reshuffle it, and then it's no more singular?
Good question, but I must say, I don't know. But there's many room for further investigation.
Thank you.
Maybe two short questions before you go on.
Yes.
So one is maybe related to what was asked before. If you take a topological theory like 3D gravity or 2D, one of these 2D Dilthey gravities, and you do these limits, do you still get a topological theory, and are they useful for something, or are they like popping up some propagating degrees of freedom then? This is my first question.
Good question. People have looked at this. I have not looked at it, but people have looked, for example, at the Carolian limits of JT gravity.
Uh-huh.
Jelle Hartung and Stefan Prohaska and various collaborators. It's not clear to me that you always will preserve the topological character. I say this in part also a little bit from my experience with non-relativistic limits of Chern-Simons theories, and they're also not necessarily still topological. So maybe in some cases, yes. That's a little committal answer, but...
Okay. Maybe we can discuss later over lunch. And the second question would be about the relation to n. Is it clear what these limits do to n equals to 4 superior mils, for example?
On the great question. Not yet. It's a concrete thing. Just do the Carolian limit of n equals 4 superior mils. Okay, you will have to understand the fermions, but it surprises me to some degree that nobody has done it yet.
Thanks.
Good question. Okay, I think it's fine. In 5 minutes, I will flash the part two because this was the main part. But there's an outlook for this that I've actually already expanded on, like. Solutions, there's still certainly room and understanding black holes, like we say. More, you know, coupling this to matter and understanding perturbations in cosmological scenarios, and the work of Germain can be used for that, for example. Connections with flat space holography. Whole story on Carroll fluids, and they, from various directions, are playing a very important role in our developments here. So I think they're there's a lot of room for that. Okay, and this is a little bit speculative.
The last item is nice, I think. Yeah. This supersonic behavior. Do you think of this analog gravity, for example?
This is inspired a little bit by the fact that Carolian symmetry appears in a cosmological setting for precisely super Hubble scales. You know, and that's precisely because, you know, the Hubble horizon expands with the speed of light. Then you can fantasize, maybe there are some interesting analog models where chiral symmetry plays a role in, you know, where the characteristic speed is not the speed of light, but the speed of sound, where you can use it for supersonic behavior. It's not meant jokingly, but we don't. We now and then we keep going to some systems and thinking it could be a cool connection to real life. Well, to realer, more real life. I mean, this quantum gravity is also real life. Okay. And then I'll finish up in 5 minutes, but people are also hungry. Okay, I'll show a couple of transparent. To string theory, and you'll see some Carolian structures appearing there. Just to set the stage, you know, so Wolfsheet string theories or bosonic theories are field theories depending on scalars. So I thought it was good to sort of take a step back, and Gerben will also expand on this much more and look at chiral scalar field theories. Just give a very quick overview of, maybe I should have started with it, but then I wouldn't be here this part. But so here's a scalar field theory. You know, put the factors of C, obviously taking chiral limit and allow yourself to rescale the potential, it gives such a Lagrangian. That's what I meant with, that's a Lagrangian dominator that only has kinetic terms. It's the scalar field theory analog of what I just showed you of the leaning order theory, just extrinsic curvature term squared. That's also obviously chiral invariant because, you can check that in various ways. Now there's another, you can call the time-like theory. There's another way that, again, using this simplified version of this Lagrangian multiplier trick, by first realizing this equivalence and then taking the C to zero limit, this also has chiral symmetry in a slightly more non-trivial way. It has gradient terms, and phi dot is set to zero because using a Lagrangian multiplier. And they have certain boost ordered entities. I will not comment on this further, but what we'll see is that actually two-dimensional field theories of the type that we find in string theory actually allow for more general chiral theories than just these bare bones or sort of simplest examples of chiral field theories. And you can find them by considering certain Wolfsheet limits of non-relativistic string theory. So what the bottom line here that maybe I show in a couple of transparencies is, okay, there's a whole story that one could give a whole talk on that we have examined with my collaborators and various other groups in the world have been very actively working on this in finding non-relativistic strings on curved spacetime. Non-relativistic strings already goes back to the 2000s. Oguri and Gomis found the action of non-relativistic strings in flat space, essentially by doing a certain scaling limit to a near-critical B field. That's been now a push of how do these objects probe a general target spacetime? And precisely there, because these general target spacetimes are some versions of non-Lorentzian geometries, a lot of progress has been made. So take this as a given, that this exists. It's some analog of the Polyakov or number go-to action, but with another space-time than Riemannian space. In fact, it's called torsional stringy Nutta-Katan space-time. Actually, motivated by connecting such models to ADS-CFT, for reasons that I can explain you, but not in this time, we were studying distinct scaling limits on the Wolfsheet. The Wolfsheet also has on the Wolfsheet, there is also a speed of light. It's not the target space-time speed of light, but the constant of proportionality between Wolfsheet time and Wolfsheet space. What we found is that you can take two limits. One gives rise to what we call a Galilean string, and it has a Galilean Wolfsheet structure. And you can show its residual symmetry algebra doing a Hamiltonian analysis is a certain subalgebra of the GCA, Virasoro cross R. But interestingly, there's yet another limit that gives what we call a Carolian string, which has a Korolian world sheet structure, and probed some other target space-time. And there the residual symmetries are the BMS 3 symmetry. As a last transparency, because I think we're all hungry, I'll just flash you, just to make it real that it exists. So the world sheet of this Korolian is sort of fibered in terms of these time-like vector fields, as opposed to the Galilean one. So here's a concrete action that you can get through all these arrows that I showed you. But the punchline is that it exhibits a Korolian world sheet structure, and it's a rather a less trivial type of scalar field theory in two dimensions than what I showed you, but it's the richness of 1+1 dimensions. And the gauge fix action has this BMS3 symmetry. We have not connected this yet to some kind of holographic setup. Interestingly enough, the Galilean string we can connect to a certain limit of ADS-CFT, to near BPS limits of ADS-CFT. So this is still an open question. Okay, so that's a good point to stop then. So with respect to this last part, there's still a lot to do. We'd like to quantize this theory, find our beta functions. So this whole novel Korolian world sheet string we like to understand better. We also like to understand better what's its connection to Korolian gravity that I discussed in the first part. And more generally, also the theme of this workshop, examine how chiral geometry, gravity, field theories connect to holography, flat space holography, and relate to corner symmetry. I'll stop here. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Laurent.
Thank you for this nice talk. I want to come back to a question that was asked earlier about this Korolian connection. It connects to something I was describing. So, you know, when we do this limit to non-horizon, I need to really understand what is the space of Korolian connection. And I was saying, for instance, it's classified by the presence of a shear tensor. There's also a twist form.
Yeah.
So. But I'm confused by your analysis of the expansion of the Einstein equation, because usually, if you don't include the shear tensor, as I was saying, the connection is singular, and you can't really take you can't really take the C goes to zero limit of the split you're taking. So I'm a little bit confused about, like, a proper Korolian description should include the Korolian connection, which in fact includes the shear tensor and the twist vector, and should allow to resolve this singularity, because this singularity is the membrane paradigm singularity. Like, it's always been, if you take a time-like surface and try to push it onto a null, you get singular connections. And this is why we need to do this complicated song and dance. So I was, I'm confused about where all that subtlety, where is it hidden and why does it disappear?
I think we have to talk in detail with equations, because I don't, so again, we have a connection which is different from the Christoffel connection, but has nice properties. Maybe the point is, what do you mean with singular? Like, we keep all, a priori, we keep all factors of C and 1 over C, and we just group things together, let's say. So like I said, like maybe that's a better way of saying it. If you take the Christoffel connection, let's say you only knew the Christoffel connection. You take the Christoffel connection, put your fields, use this parameterization, splitting out C squared. What you will see is there's a C squared bit, or a C to the zero, and 1 over C squared. That's just even before expanding. But you can also really look at what's there geometrically. So in front of the C, by the way, C squared would be diverging in the non-relativistic limit, and 1 over C squared would be diverging in the opposite limit. It so turns out, but I don't know if this answers your question, that these pieces, both the C-squared and the 1 over C-squared term, are purely tensorial. And it's only in the C to the 0 part that it's something that transforms like a connection. Maybe I should have said it clearer. So that's also what gives... So C to the 0 transforms like a connection. You can just check it. Then it's a little bit... there's some finger speech and feel of splitting off a nice part of that that you call the connection. So the C to the 0 part will be connection plus tensor, and it's sort of up to you how you want to split off a tensor there. But so these diverging pieces, for us, they're tensorial, and we just take them along for the ride, and they enter in the action. Does that? It's. By the way, it's very. Just going back on the non. It had confused many people. Go back to the non-relativistic case. Dort Kuhr did a very visionary paper expanding for large speed of light. He precisely saw these diverging pieces. He could see, I can kill them if I assume absolute time. So he killed them using absolute time. But by that, he made a major truncation of the theory, and it was actually not necessary to kill them. So let's say and then various people realized there's no reason to kill them because you can take them along for the ride. But yeah, talking more detail.
We have a last question by Andrea.
Yeah, so you mentioned that if you keep the next leading order, you have a bigger symmetry with respect to Carroll. But what is it? So it's enough to recover the full symmetries of GR, keeping two orders? Ah. So you have some intermediate structure between the two?
Thanks for the question, because I didn't have time to say it, and it's sort of a nice story. So you can show, again, both in the non-relativistic case and the ultra-local case, that the symmetry at the given order is a certain truncation of the so-called Lie algebra expansion of the Poincaré group. Okay. And there's sort of there's a well-defined mathematical framework. So at every order, the number of symmetry generators get doubled. So at this next to leading order, there's an algebra that's twice, that has a number of generators twice as many as the Poincaré group. It has as a sub-algebra the Carroll algebra, but twice as many generators. And some kind of complicated commutation relations, but for which there's a fixed recipe using Lie algebra expansions to get. So in that sense, you precisely have the Carroll geometrical objects plus further gauge fields, what I call phi mu nu and mu coming from the sub-leading fields. And that big symmetry group just acts in a certain known way on these fields. Okay. So it's kind of interesting, I don't know if it's interesting, but a priori, at any order in the expansion, you know what the symmetry is. And I would claim the action at any order would be the unique two-derivative action that satisfies those symmetries. You wouldn't want to write them down sort of bottom-up, but that's sort of the structure.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks Niels again for...
Okay.